It's Thursday, October 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton prepare for their final face-to-face debate in front of voters.
He sees it as a step in the rebalancing of Philippine foreign policy.
The Philippines president visits China amid the backdrop of the South China Sea. Also ahead, does history point to a financial market crash? And new country music marks years of collaboration. It's all on today's International Edition. Republican Donald Trump and Democrat Hillary Clinton are heading to their third debate in their acrimonious run for the U.S. presidency. This will be the last time that millions of Americans will have a chance to see them square off as they trade taunts and policy positions on a wide range of issues. Clinton, the one-time U.S. Secretary of State, is looking to become the country's first female president. She will show up on the debate stage in Las Vegas, Nevada, with a growing lead in political polls over Trump, the brash real estate tycoon who is running for elected office for the very first time. It is perhaps his last best chance to cut into her 7-point percentage advantage over with less than 3 weeks remaining before the November 8th election. Both have declared each other as unfit to become the country's 45th president when President Barack Obama leaves office in late January, and they've traded barbs on their Twitter accounts ahead of their high-stakes face-to-face encounter. As we enter the final few weeks of the presidential race, about 15% of voters remain undecided. That's a lot. Who the undecideds eventually vote for could have an impact on the election, if they vote at all. And the reason for a vote is a bit skewed. A USA Today survey indicates 36% of millennials voting for their candidate just so that the other one doesn't get elected. It's also the same percentage for both presidential nominees. VOA's Carolyn Pursuti takes a look at how all of this might affect the outcome in the battleground state of Ohio.
Millennial voters on the campus of Ohio State University, a swing state that's a toss-up for both presidential candidates. And like many here, these first-year voters haven't decided which candidate to support.
There's just things that have come up in both of their past that just kind of freaks me out about both of them.
Both Langan and Dela Fuente will vote, but have to convince other students to do the same.
When one person starts saying, oh, I'm not going to vote this year, you kind of just throw your vote away, whereas you could make a difference really voting for someone that even though you don't want to vote for them, you kind of have to.
Senior Seth Burt disagrees, connecting his beliefs to the benefits of a democracy.
You have that right to vote or to not vote. And I think, you know, if I voted, if you ever have to choose between the lesser of two evils, it's never going to be a good outcome. So I'd rather not partake in it.
Burt isn't alone. Millennials say they want to send a message that they are the largest generation and politicians need to start reaching them. Older voters are also unsure if they will vote. At the Rock Power and Politics exhibit at Cleveland's Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, Ginger Cunningham says neither candidate cares about her son's future.
I worry about him and I try to keep things small, and I guess I often push away the big picture because it is a scary picture.
Like the musicians in the exhibit, Steven Salinger says he might revolt with his support of Libertarian candidate Gary Johnson.
It's a vote against the establishment and just somebody different, because these two people I don't think will do very well. Either one gets elected.
Like here in Ohio, the undecided voter nationally could carry a great impact. Up to 20% say they don't know which way they're going to vote. That's three times as many as the last presidential election. That percentage traditionally declines as we get close to the election and voters become more committed. But this election, experts say we may never get a clear number because the candidates are so polarizing.
There seem to be undecideds, and the question always becomes on undecided. Are they undecided, or have they decided and don't want to say?
We find out what those decisions are on November 8th. Carolyn Pursuti, VOA News in Ohio.
Trump and Clinton have sparred on the debate stage two times already, with credible polls showing that Mrs. Clinton won both times, But analysts thought that Trump performed better in his second matchup with her 10 days ago and could, with a strong debate performance and pointed attacks on her, give undecided and wavering Clinton supporters a new reason to consider casting a ballot for him. Some U.S. states are already holding early voting. Fox News television anchor Chris Wallace will be quizzing both Mr. Trump and Mrs. Clinton about six topics: immigration, social benefit entitlements for Americans, and the country's long-term debt, Supreme Court appointments, the economy, foreign policy, and each candidate's fitness to serve as president. Should be some interesting answers to that one. Well, it's time for us now to check out the pulse on social media. As always, International Edition's G. Abby Lee joins me in the studio with the trending stories. Hi, G.
Hi, Jim. It will definitely be interesting tonight. And of course, we have to lead with a third and a final presidential debate in the United States for our social media segment. People are tweeting about the guest list for both parties, and here's an example. Hillary Clinton has invited former Hewlett-Packard head Meg Whitman to the debate, who is a GOP candidate for California governor, proposing slashing welfare. This tweet is poking fun at the fact that the political activist and business executive is, one, a Republican, and two, a proponent of lower welfare, which are not exactly in line with Clinton's beliefs. On the other side of the spectrum, many are also pointing out the fact that her opponent, Donald Trump, invited President Barack Obama's half-brother to the debate. Malik Obama, as you know, is born and raised in Kenya, is an outspoken critic of Hillary Clinton.
Well, that should make for an interesting visual.
That's right.
So what's the overriding sentiment about the debate online?
Honestly, Jim, the most prevalent opinion was that the debate should be more about the candidates and topics rather than all the hoopla around it. Daniel Nichinen with the University of Chicago sent out this tweet. There should be no audience in the debate hall. Only candidates and moderators. No family, no staff, no attempts at gimmicks. More than 1,000 people liked that tweet. He's also a contributing writer to the popular opinion poll analytics website 538, and he's on Twitter at Taniel with a T.
Okay, well, no audience. Maybe that'll be something for the future. What else do we have?
So the New York Times named a new deputy publisher, Arthur Greg Sulzberger. He's 36 and was chosen out of three candidates. But before all of our listeners say, oh my gosh, what am I doing with my life? He's 36. I have to add, he may have had some advantage in the process. He's a son of the New York Times publisher and poised to eventually take over his father's position. Mm. The other two candidates were his cousins. Jim, back to you.
All right. Very interesting things. Thank you so much for that wrap-up, G. You can follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. That's our International Edition Twitter stream. And also on our own individual accounts at VOA Stevenson and at G. Abby Lee. Among the top stories that are trending in Asia: super typhoon slams into northeastern Philippines. Protesters repeatedly rammed by police van outside of U.S. Embassy in Philippines. At least 80 children sickened by food poisoning in Cambodia. Pakistan bans broadcast of Indian content. China using ecological protection to boost its claims in disputed waters. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at the voanews.com website. And if you have a smartphone, you can check out all of our stories and videos on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte, joined by dozens of businessmen, is on a three-day official visit to China in what the state-run news agency Xinhua described as ice-breaking after years of estrangement. It proclaimed that a good faith is replacing bad blood. Xinhua said that it comes at a time when China-Philippines ties have nosedived to a historical low because of what it calls the farcical South China Sea arbitration case brought by Mr. Duterte's predecessor, Benigno Aquino, against China. It called the visit a litmus test of his sincerity and political wisdom. Mr. Duterte is seeking improved commercial ties with Beijing and is quoted as saying that he is open to hold joint military exercises with China and Russia. At the same time, he has indicated that he may end such exercises with the United States. He has been angered by U.S. criticism of his war on drugs, in which thousands have died. Asia Society analyst Stephen Rood in Manila tells VOA's Victor Beatty that Mr. Duterte has obliquely referred to his visit as crossing the Rubicon, or passing the point of no return.
He sees it as a step in the rebalancing of Philippine foreign policy from the distinctly close to American tilt of his predecessor with a very frosty relations with China. He is now trying to make it close relations with China. This has all sorts of dimensions. There is the tourist dimension. There is the investment dimension. A Chinese billionaire has even taken part in the war against drugs by financing a rehabilitation center in Luzon. And, of course, there are the diplomatic issues that could come up. So there are many facets that he expects to discuss, and he will be seeing the president of China and have a one-on-one with him.
The state news agency Xinhua in China signaled how China hopes to use this visit to regain lost ground in the Philippines after that major arbitration lawsuit against China's territorial claims in the South China Sea.
That's right. The stand of President Duterte is that the arbitral decision is part of the context, but because it can't be enforced and the power relations are so asymmetric, he's not going to try to bluster or rub China's face in it. Rather, he's going to be looking for mutually agreeable, mutually beneficial arrangements that could be made. For instance, the Chinese Coast Guard once again allowing the Philippine fishermen to fish at Scarborough Shoal, which is one of the aspects of the arbitral decision, based on the fact that they've been doing it since time immemorial, as have Chinese fishermen. So according to the arbitral tribunal, both sets of fishermen have the right to fish there.
Do you sense a fundamental shift in relations with the U.S.?
It's hard to sense a fundamental relationship in such a shift when the average Filipino, as is evidenced in a survey on the front page of one of the newspapers today, the average Filipino is very much more trusting of the United States than of China. And we have millions of Filipino Americans who send home billions of dollars from the United States. So these fundamental people-to-people kinds of factors are a context within which any maneuvering happens.
The Asian Society's Stephen Rood said the U.S.-Philippines relationship has seen its ups and downs, and this is the latest cooling-off period. But a fundamental shift in those ties, he says, is constrained by a number of factors, including the two countries' long and close cultural, political, and security ties. On this day, 29 years ago, U.S. markets suffered their largest one-day loss in a stock market crash that still remains largely a mystery as to why it happened. VOA financial correspondent Jill Malandrino joins us from New York with a look back to that dark day for investors and if there's any correlation to some talk that markets today are set up for a huge pullback.
Let's talk about some history, because that's always the interesting part of these anniversaries. After the dust settled, the S&P 500 fell an incredible 20.5% October 9th in 87 for the single worst day ever for the index, earning the well-deserved nickname Black Friday. Now, the question is, could this happen again for the remainder of 2016? Now, while anything is possible, there are some major differences between now and 87. Going back to 87, there's still arguments over exactly what caused the crash. The bottom line is 87 saw a near vertical start to the year. If you recall, the beginning of 2016, we were down at the low, February 11th, down 14%. The bottom line is in 87, we saw a vertical start to the beginning of the year and was up to close to 40% for the year at the start of September. Now, recall in our markets in 2016, we were down at the low on February 11th by 14%. So there's definitely divergence in the composure of the market at that point. So in other words, stocks were extremely stretched in 87, making a large pullback much more likely. Now, Ryan Dietrich of LPL Research, he makes an excellent point. He says, the bottom line is no 2 years are ever the same. And to suggest that they are, would make an analyst very uninformed. So you can do all the chart comparisons that you want. In other words, what's called technical analysis. But like they say in investing, future performance is never indicative of the past.
That's very true. And markets now searching for some direction as oil is above $50 a barrel, but it doesn't seem to clarify things.
It doesn't. Oil actually moved over the key $52 level. And this is following comments that were made in London by Saudi Arabia's Minister of Energy and Industry. He said that other nations are willing to join OPEC in cutting production to secure improvement in oil prices, but he did not specify which countries. So far, only Russia has made that commitment. But this rebound that we've seen in oil over the past couple of weeks, it's solely due to OPEC. And that has nothing to do with a persistent downtrend in supply. You have to remember, as oil prices creep higher, producers ramp up production in an effort to generate revenue, which means more supply floods an already stressed system, and that will depress prices. We saw a bit of a drawdown last week, but that was, of course, due to Hurricane Matthew. So the inventory data this week is going to be a little bit more of a tell. So while the commodities complex can be complex, it really always comes back to the basic fundamentals of supply and demand. And right now, this market is at record supply.
We have a record supply of great information out of New York, thanks to Jill Malandrino. You'll find her here on International Edition and on Twitter at Jill Malandrino.
Awesome. Thank you.
And be sure to visit voanews.com for much more on economics and any other subject you might want to look up. You can also follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE and check out our Facebook page at VOA Now. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
The U.S. presidential election takes place on November 8, 2016. VOA provides extensive coverage of this important political event. Who are the candidates, and what are the issues that will determine who the next president will be? Tune in around the clock for coverage of the U.S. presidential election, right here on VOA.
Hi there, this is Larry London, the host of Border Crossings. Nice to meet you. I would love for you to join us each and every day, Monday through Friday, on Border Crossings for requests, dedications, giveaways, and surprise guests. We've got some of today's biggest hitmakers coming into the studio to talk about their music. And all we're missing is you. So join us Monday to Friday, right here on Border Crossings. This is the Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. The Country Music Association, one of the most influential ambassadors of country music, is turning 50 this year. My, how time flies. To honor the milestone, the CMA brought a one-time gathering of 30 artists to record a new song that's already making history. Nikki Strong of VOA 1 joins International Edition host Sarah Williams with details.
It's called Forever Country. It's a mashup of three iconic country songs: John Denver's Take Me Home, Country Roads, Willie Nelson's On the Road Again, and Dolly Parton's I Will Always Love You. It was recorded in 3 days in Nashville in June with Shane McAnally as the producer.
So how did they choose these three songs?
Well, it's a combination of things. Originally, it was just going to be a song along with a video. But as they were brainstorming, they decided to ask Joseph Kahn, who is the Grammy Award-winning director of Taylor Swift's Bad Blood video, since he was going to direct the video. They said, you know, they asked him, were there any country songs that he would like to do? And after some thought, he was like, you know what? One song really won't capture the rich history of country music, so why don't we do a mashup of, like, three songs? And that is when the awesome producer Shane McAnally was brought in to make that happen, especially since he is also on the CMA board.
Well, that's a big task to undertake.
Yes, it is. He was scared at first, understandably, despite how talented he is. He considered 40 songs, 40 of them. And, you know, one of his concerns was that country songs have narratives. And so he didn't want to take snippets of songs and then undermine the narrative of each song. He wanted to do each song justice, as well as do the overall mashup justice. The songs he considered were previous CMA Song of the Year winners, or at least were nominated, and had like universal themes that could sound like a love song to the country genre. So these three wound up making it, to make a long story short. And I personally think he did a fantastic job. And I'm not the only one. The song debuted in the number one spot on the Billboard Hot Country Singles chart. It's the third ever to do so. And that also enables each artist that is on that song have a number one hit on the charts as well.
Oh, fabulous.
Yes.
So how did they choose the artists?
Okay, so at first they didn't know how many artists were going to participate and decided to narrow down the list by considering only previous CMA winners. So they wanted artists of then, now, and forever, as they called it. So they reached out to many, and about 30 were able to do it. And the list includes Dolly Parton, Miranda Lambert, Alabama, Charlie Pride, Luke Bryan, Willie Nelson, to name a few. The song is great, as I said, as well as the video that goes along with it. And also all the profits from the sale and streaming of the song go towards music education sponsored, supported by the CMA Foundation.
Well, you can hear Forever Country by artists of then, now, and forever on VOA One's Country Hits with Nikki Strong. You can also see the video on Facebook and Twitter at VOA One The Hits. Thanks a lot, Nikki.
You're welcome.
And
you've been listening to International Edition. You'll find us always at our home on voanews.com. Be sure to check out our Facebook page, VOA Now, and also our Twitter stream at VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter. We welcome our good friend Vortec back to our engineer's chair. Good to see you again. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We thank you for joining us. We hope you come back again. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
There has been significant progress in the fight against ISIL on the ground, and the next big offensive is now underway, the battle to liberate Mosul from ISIL oppression. The operation to regain control of Iraq's second-largest city will take time. Iraq is supported by a wide range of coalition capabilities, including air support, artillery, intelligence advisors, and forward air controllers. The coalition has built a force of over 30,000 fighters for this operation, including Kurdish Peshmerga, Iraqi security forces, and some 14,000 local Nineveh fighters. This liberation battle comes after more than 2 years of ISIL oppression in Mosul, during which they committed horrible atrocities. Over 1 million people in Mosul are living under the boot of ISIL, including most of the Yazidi slaves who were taken by ISIL 2 years ago. ISIL is also on the run in Syria. Opposition forces there liberated the Syrian town of Dabiq from ISIL control, aided by support from Turkey and the international coalition. Dabiq held symbolic importance to ISIL. The group carried out unspeakable atrocities in Dabiq, named its English language magazine after the town, and claimed it would be the site of a final victory for the so-called caliphate, said U.S. Secretary of Defense Ash Carter in a written statement. In the military operation to drive ISIL out of Manbij, Syria, coalition fighters uncovered a trove of ISIL's foreign fighters and information about where they're planning and plotting their strategy. Coalition forces uncovered over 15 terabytes of material. This intelligence is being mined and shared with global coalition members. Aside from territory, ISIL is losing its leaders. Since August 30th, the United States has taken out more than 18 ISIL leaders, including Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi's deputy, Mohammed Adnani, who was the leader of all their external operations. After the fall of Manbij, many of ISIL's leaders left wherever they were and gathered elsewhere. It is clear that ISIL is on the run, and its safe haven is shrinking rapidly. The United States and its coalition partners will not rest until the job is done and ISIL is utterly and completely defeated.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.